Welcome to the Command Line Podcast for April 16th, 2013. I'm your host, Thomas Command Line Gideon, a self-proclaimed hacker, eccentric, and hacktivist. This is my show about the practice and profession of programming, drawing on well over a decade of professional experience and a lifetime spent hacking, the intersection of technology with society and public policy, and anything else clever, elegant, or funny that catches my mind as a diehard technology geek. This episode is a newscast in which I discuss several of the stories that caught my attention over the past handful of weeks, including you'll never believe how much data remains on smartphones that have been explicitly wiped. Mozilla is making the web a gaming platform with a port of the Unreal 3 engine to the browser, the hacker lifecycle, and Project Gutenberg surpasses a key milestone. All of this and more. First, though, a couple of things. Friend of the podcast, who I interviewed some time ago, Ed Piscor, wrote me, among others, to let us know of an upcoming new book release from, I believe, Fantagraphics. I'll include a link so you can pre-order if you're interested this book, this history of hip-hop, the hip-hop family tree that's coming out in the fall from Amazon and, of course, is being syndicated for free like the WYSIWYG comics were, as Ed was working on both the original self-published version of that and then ultimately the nice hardbound reworked version of that as well. I'm glad to help spread the word of the great work that Ed does, again, very much in this awesome graphic novel documentarian vein. Also, I wanted to call attention to an event that for those especially who came through the mention on Boing Boing recently about my talk at Northeast Linux Fest, to an event that I'm very interested in. I'm privileged that a colleague in New York that also works with me at the Open Technology Institute as part of my day job coordinates this, Techno-Activism Third Mondays. There's one coming up May 20th. It doesn't look like I'll be able to get up to New York, but hopefully for one of the ones coming up soon, I'll be able to come up and participate and get a sense of if this is the sort of space that I've been thinking of and that really inspired my desire for, which really inspired the talk that I shared at the Linux Fest. And then if that all lines up, we've started some conversations about potentially bringing techno-activism Third Mondays to DC as well. So this is something that very much in the spirit of Copy Night that I referenced in the talk would be a monthly occurrence to bring together exactly the same sort of diverse thinkers with a strong technology bent overall or technology interest overall to discuss through issues of activism and public policy and the like. So I'll report back on that as it unfolds and as I have a chance to work with the wonderful folks at the Open Internet Tools Project more closely about helping them spread this around. I know that it started in New York last year and it's spread and been picked up in a couple of other cities besides. So if you do a little bit of searching online specifically for techno activism Third Mondays, you'll find a couple of other locations where it has cropped up, and I'll include a link to the one in New York for folks that are there, or can easily travel there, or happen to be there and might be interested. Like many of you, I have a home network and several systems to secure, so I follow reports of security vulnerabilities with special interest. Each week, I pick a couple of those to talk about here, both to cement them in my mind and to raise some awareness. Matt Honan at Wired's Gadget Lab, who you might remember for the very honest telling of the hacking of all of his Apple devices and the remote wiping, wrote another interesting piece, this time digging into exactly what resetting a smartphone actually does in terms of wiping personal data. As it turns out, not so much. He worked with a computer forensics expert who tried to recover data from a handful of phones that Honan scrounged from his coworkers. The sample set was small, but actually pretty diverse, including both smartphones and feature phones, as well as both iOS, Apple devices, and Android. All of the phones had recoverable data on them, though the quantity and type of which did vary. In most cases, the investigator was able to dig out the owner's identity. Not all cases, but definitely most of them. This doesn't surprise me. I've read stories about recoverable data from phones for some time now. This is a problem that clearly we need to exert some pressure to get vendors to do better. I even had a secondhand story of this kind of data recovery in practice when the original owner, parents of a friend of mine, turned the phone back into the carrier for recycling, and the presumption being that they'd wipe it, which suggests that even they don't have any better tools. The carriers themselves don't have any way to do more than a factory reset, which is all that was really used in the examples in this article. The implication is that both bad actors and law enforcers can trivially recover data, work around these insufficient protections. The forensics expert both performs this recovery as a service, as he did in the case working with Honan here, but also sells the necessary tools for anyone to do the same. And the implication here is pretty clear that even if folks can't afford or don't want to be identified through the transaction of acquiring this equipment, it's probably not hard to cobble together some of this stuff in a DIY fashion. So the risk here is rather manifest. Honan concludes with the key question: what can the typical person do? The answer is, unfortunately, not much, at least with the stock capabilities in the phones as we buy them. I'm not sure I would even trust any third-party apps that promise a secure wipe. Some of the limitations do have to do with the way that flash memory actually works physically, about which I profess not being an expert, but I believe it does make the sort of durable deletion that helps prevent or make recovery of data more costly difficult, much more so than with traditional hard drives, with spinning media hard drives. I'm forced to agree with the suggestion the expert offered that physical destruction is really the only effective means to keep data on old phones safe. An article at Mashable discussed an interesting application of cheap brain-computer interfaces, using them to replace passwords with what they refer to somewhat cutely as pass thoughts. The research behind this was done at Berkeley and used commodity EEG headsets, commonly sold with a variety of thought-controlled or brainwave-controlled games, but can be used here to read signals from users asked to perform certain mental tasks. The security advantages are apparently twofold. The first is the selection of the mental task, comparable to picking an obscure phrase or a jumbling of alphanumeric characters and symbols to formulate a password. Second is that the EEG signals themselves produced during this task are indeed specific to individuals, similar to biometrics. As the article explains, even if someone else guessed the mental task correctly and performed it, the reading from the EEG would not match, preventing correct authentication if this were used as suggested for passwords. This is an interesting reflection of other research I've discussed, where some work has been done to look into what EEG devices, sold innocuously, as I said, for gaming purposes, most commonly today, may actually leak and how that may lead to exploitable vulnerabilities. I have to imagine this is susceptible to similar leakage and would require any use for actual authentication to use some form of encryption or other way of protecting against these sorts of leakages, or other means to prevent someone from using, say, an EEG logger, as analogous to a key logger for capturing passwords as typed in, to capture and play back that EEG signal. Unlike other biometrics, the selection of a task overcomes the revocation problem, something that I think a lot of proponents of biometrics are a little too blithe in overlooking. If a fingerprint or a retina image is duplicated, or facial dynamics, or any number of metrics tied to our physiology, if those are duplicated and then used to spoof you in an authentication system, there really isn't much that you can do. In the thought exercise of an EEG logger, just like a key logger snagging a password, as I said, there is something the user can change if they suspect a compromise. To restore security, they can pick another task. I'm sure there's quite a bit more work to do before using this in practice, but it is an interesting idea that may prove useful in the long run. Here are the news stories that caught my eye this week. For more, check out the website at thecommandline.net. Peter Bright at Ars Technica was one of several folks to report exciting news from GDC, the Game Developers Conference. Mozilla and Epic showed off a port of the latter's Unreal 3 game engine that has been successfully made to run in a browser. This is made possible by Nscripten, a tool to compile C++ to JavaScript, and ASM.js, a high-performance subset of a JavaScript. ASM, they're referring obliquely to assembly, or at least certain flavors of assembly language, very low-level, high-performance computer language, just a step above machine code. Let that sink in for a minute. One high-level language being compiled into an even higher-level scripting language. I thought porting things like a working Unix shell into JavaScript were impressive. As the embedded video reveals, though, the result here is near indistinguishable from a game running natively. Everything you expect to see in a high-quality 3D title is present, from atmospheric effects to smooth animations and dynamic lighting. Bright writes that the goal is for WebGL to be able to support all kinds of game, not just the casual games that are currently most common in browsers, and even then often reliant entirely on plugins like Flash, but all kinds of games and natively. He goes on to speculate that the move is a reaction to games as a driver of the proliferation of native apps on mobile platforms. The implication is that Firefox OS, Mozilla's new mobile initiative, the browser-focused mobile platform from that outfit, will also support this level of capability for 3D gaming, since it uses a lot of the core technologies found in Firefox itself. Mobile processors certainly have the horsepower with systems on chips that they're often built off of, often including dedicated GPU cores to rival consoles and even, in some cases, PCs. The balance of the article discusses the key remaining challenges. Games rely on a ton of media to build the immersive worlds and stories we enjoy. Even with relatively high-speed local storage, native games themselves, outside of what we're talking about here, can take a few seconds to load the next bit of a story's narrative or a fresh level. Doing the same thing over even a high-speed internet link, so a gigabit fiber, I guess that's approaching maybe disk speeds, but anything less than that would really expand that from seconds to minutes. I have two reactions to this thought: agreement about this being a deal breaker, but also amazement that everything else about such games in a browser can now be taken for granted. This is the last thing that we're dickering about, our level load times. The group behind OpenGL, Chronos, the more established standard for 3D, especially Open 3D on personal computers, and also responsible for WebGL, is already working on this problem, setting out to define some common data formats. The idea, I guess, is like where we're at for, say, web typography. With open formats for fonts and the ability to actually install them rather than load every time, designers are less limited by the same sort of load times when it comes to advanced websites. If something similar could be developed across browsers, then a media could download once or even reuse materials that a player has already downloaded for a different game. It remains to be seen if these remaining challenges can be overcome. More importantly, and not mentioned, is which studio, or probably more likely in my view, indie creator, will take the plunge and offer compelling must-have titles, not for existing platforms, but for the web, at least alongside of those other choices, if not ideally, exclusively, to really drive this as a killer app. Given the approach demonstrated here, while the incremental cost and effort seems low, the overall input required to develop top-shelf games is still quite high, and some very compelling reason is going to have to emerge for web delivery versus other means. Time had a good interview with computing pioneer Alan Kay. If you don't recognize his name, there's a good brief introduction to set the stage in the article. A lot of the discussion revolved around education, not surprisingly. Kay is responsible for a concept that inspired, among other things, the touchscreen tablet form factor of the latest OLPC computer, the XO. Despite the obvious comparison, he is clear about the core model being most important. He talks about the computer extending existing literacy to digital forms and media, and most critically, in an entirely symmetric way. A superficial dig at the iPad and iPhone actually has deep roots related to the Dynabook, that's that core concept he came up with, as a system where kids could share, and not only share, but build on each other's work. In that way, a more apt comparison might be the web, especially the ability to view source, and for anyone who has access to or can stand up a server, to build on what they see in other people's web applications and web pages. The first couple of questions, first about education, then about computing more generally, seem to evoke a bit of a down response, a lament that the early potential of computers has yet to be fully reached in Kay's view. Kay seems to think that some of this is structural, that the most popular uses of computing technologies are also the most facile. He refers to work by a pioneer of his at Xerox PARC, Douglas Engelbart. This is a man who, among other things, came up with the mouse. But actually, like Kay, it's actually some of the conceptual work that he did around organization of information, access of that productivity and effectiveness that's far more important, and especially for that potential that Kay speaks to not being realized, really key. His references there are really key. The interface Engelbart imagined as part of that more productivity-facing work took some skill and training, even by his own admission, to master, but the point was that the investment in so doing was time well spent, and the ability to far better match the computer's support, its advanced capabilities to reading and writing, and also, very critically, just thinking. That last comes through in glimpses throughout the interview, that Kay and his contemporaries clearly saw the computer as an aid not just to communicating, but also to modeling out ideas, trying things out, viewing them in ways not otherwise possible. It would be easy to read a certain elitism in some of his remarks, especially considering that it is possible to get closer to this early vision if you're willing to learn how to program, to write code, and to dig deeper that way. I don't think that was the intent of these ideas, though. Rather, that the interface ideas and ways of working were meant to be accessible to all, hence the real disappointment that they are not widespread in any meaningful way. Kay touches on some of the reasons why modern computing may be considered a bit stunted, especially compared to some of the original ideas, like a lack of real, usable, general-purpose artificial intelligence, that being one small part. This was a component originally envisioned to go with overlapping Windows, with mice and pointers and all of the things that we've come to expect from a graphical user interface. The interview touches on helpful agents as one part of that original thinking, a part that hasn't manifested, but in talking through why that's so, I think there is another clear implication. Much of the failures or shortcomings of modern computing perhaps arise from a lack of basic research and intentionality around that. We have networks and at least the interfaces we do have because of the early approach to funding by DARPA. Shifting innovation over to pretty much exclusively the market, misaligned the incentives towards the easy, the quick, rather than the truly transformative, like the potentials encapsulated in a lot of the ideas of Kay and his contemporaries. The rest of the interview covers Kay's experiences working at some of these market innovators. He spoke most glowingly, not surprisingly, about the creatives at Disney, who were given largely a free hand to do pretty much whatever they wanted. This is mirrored in his discussion of being a fellow at several companies, more generally, that at least originally such a role was about independent thinking, and the support to both spawn new projects at will, and to advise management on existing projects very freely, just based on the trust of being a fellow and a deep thinker. Given some of the recent criticism of computers and computer networks by less deep thinkers, like, well, Evgeny Morozov, but not exclusively him, I'd say this piece, despite the slightly down tone at the start, is worthwhile. It's a much more constructive take on deep and thoughtful criticism. The point isn't that computers can't do good in social justice or even basic human betterment terms, but that they are indeed falling short, and we have to understand why if we want to fix that. Corey at Boing Boing linked to a new API being introduced by Mozilla to support payments for its mobile platform, Firefox OS, and hopefully, by extension, the web in general. Kumar McMillan, writing about the new approach, highlights the problems with existing payment handling online. Despite how easy most options are to set up for a website administrator or operator, they restrict customer choice. You can only select from the supported options rather than any payment processor. Despite the ease of setup, online merchants have to support and handle rather a lot, including safe handling of credit card information if that's supported. The third parties that address these well aren't particularly well integrated into the web in general, so the thinking is there's an opportunity for an open API, a common API, to help change that. Mozilla is introducing their first efforts as a navigator function, MozPay. Mozilla is adding this to Firefox OS, where the need is clearest, given that this is a common aspect of mobile platforms and ecosystems, and that their competitors in these spaces already have these built in some sense. In fact, Mozilla's approach is partly inspired by Google's work on Wallet, the main difference being Mozilla is expanding it to allow more open participation from third-party payment processors and services. The rest of the article walks through how the API works in a fair amount of detail. At the heart is the generation of a JSON formatted token that is signed with the application secret, part of a key pair generated when creating Firefox OS applications or Mozilla web packaged applications. These are generated for a particular app, not even for particular authors, the implication here, but specific to apps, which is kind of cool and an interesting way to compartmentalize some of the authentication and potentially some of the security. This JSON Web Token, or JWT, is what gets sent along to a payment processor with URLs then to call back to when the user either successfully or unsuccessfully completes the purchase transaction, the actual payment transaction. Right now, the system requires a server to support the necessary exchanges. To make that easier, Mozilla has developed supporting libraries in Python and for Node.js. They are also thinking about, though don't have anything yet to share, about how to reduce or eliminate the requirement for that intermediary server so that all a developer would need is the browser itself that the user, of course, already has. The article concludes with some good points about innovation. First is that an open system like this fosters more experimentation than the few options we have now for handling purchases on the web and for mobile platforms. I have definitely encountered requests for me as a content creator to support donations via more services than I already do. Each one is comparable, is a constant cost. It's not like there's a diminishing curve, like it gets easier with each one that I add. Really an open API then like this would get me to that point where there's truly only an incremental cost for supporting new mechanisms that people want to see supported alongside of more popular ones, offering more choice. Second is that with all the hand-wringing over ads and privacy, especially with the reaction most sites and services have to ad blocking in particular, making direct payment easier for everyone really does, I think, allow more business model experimentation. I know that for mobile in particular, I've started spending more for content, partly because the experience is so seamless and partly because, well, I hate ads and if I have the option to opt out by spending a few bucks, I'm happy to do so, but also because it allows the price point really to scale down to almost a no-brainer, an impulse buy. I can buy a pack of gum or I can buy a game that's going to keep me entertained on my daily commute for at least several weeks, if not for some of the highly replayable games that I've been very fortunate to buy for months at a time. Where I might hesitate for a $20 video disc or a $25 hardcover novel or a $50 game disc, I rarely do when considering price points that are generally at or below $5 for most of these when purchased in digital form through online distribution channels. I'm not saying I would switch paying directly for all content I'm used to reading for free or at the cost of just the attention paid to the inline advertising, but I would be far more open to paying at least some of the time if the price was right and it kept the content flowing in much the same way in a much lower friction environment like this API suggests. Slashdot linked to a post by Benjamin Alexander Smith with the intriguing title, The Hacker Lifecycle. My first thought was of the development stages that may be considered specific to the evolution of a hacker from early days to maturity and even on late in life. What Smith is actually describing is an annual cycle relating to ongoing education. He talks about his desire to always be learning and in the process doing something new, and how that tends to follow a predictable unfolding over any given year. I think this desire is a widely held trait among hackers, and I'm sure that what he describes is similar, maybe to varying degrees and at different timescales, to how many others express it. What he lays out is four phases, each about 2 to 3 months. First is focus efforts towards a goal, in particular a life goal. Second is structured education. Third is side projects to practice newly acquired skills. And last is burning out and resting before starting all over again. In digging into these a bit more, Smith's particular views emerge in that initial goal-setting phase. He admits this has more to do with financial independence. I think this is where many hackers might vary, myself included. Self-sufficiency is undoubtedly important to a lot of us, but my sense is that simple curiosity may more often factor into choosing learning a goal, life scale or otherwise. As he describes in the subsequent phases, another difference from my first impressions arises. I had thought he was going to talk about how all the phases are related to one theme or general outcome. Rather, the subsequent phases have more to do with shifting motivations. Again, coming back to his income potential and hence shift in skills being acquired more opportunistically. What also changes then in response to the motivational ebb and flow is how Smith himself keeps up with skill and knowledge acquisition. Between phases 2 and 3, there does seem to be a bit more continuity in that the side projects are often built using what was gained in the structured education phase. The last phase is clearly downtime, and I guess what I find unusual is that there is so much of it all at once, rather than interspersed as natural pauses between sprints of self-tutelage and projects. Again, I think this is more a motivational cycle, and Smith does refer to it in almost so many words. I like that he clearly wrote the piece as a self-reflection and asks as part of it if the cycle works for him. He generally seems to think so and only suggests some intention as he restarts phase one might be welcome, maybe doing some longer range planning around projects. I have to wonder how much of what he describes is narrowed by his own admitted focus on entrepreneurship. I read his about page for context and immediately spotted that he labels himself as an entrepreneur. Usually this is a turnoff for me. It's a label that I don't generally look upon positively, especially when self-selected, as it clearly puts monetary motivation first. And again, I'm revealing my biases here that my second career is about more mission-driven projects and a realization of shared values for social justice and similar outcomes. I think the cycle he describes pretty clearly reinforces that, though. But there are some learning and other goal-driven things going on here, which do beg the questions he asks of the reader, then. How many other hackers go through similar cycles? He clearly wants to know, in order to improve his, and I suspect, to the benefit of his wallet. I'm curious, too, but more broadly in terms of how hackers' motivations in general ebb and flow, and in what practical day-to-day, month-after-month ways those manifest, especially for a young person. I get that security is a large part of this, but I'm curious about more broad, encompassing cycles, too, that speak to more than just independence and support. Regardless, this does have me thinking, and I may come back to it soon with my own take. Some of the stories that catch my attention during the week are actually continuations of stories or themes that I've discussed before. I like to set aside a little extra time to go over those and follow up. Mike Masnick at TechDirt noted a couple of weeks ago concrete evidence that CISPA, the cybersecurity bill, is back. This is the bill that would provide a safe harbor, among other things, to the likes of Facebook and Google if they share user information with government and law enforcers. It was planned for markup by the House Intelligence Committee last week, which happened without fixing any of the concerns raised by critics. As the Post notes, it's also happened behind closed doors. The article on TechDirt has links to the further developments since this story first came around, many of which I've also included in my weekly follow-ups for last week, just that went up on the website a couple of days ago. The only possible silver lining is the White House isn't really supporting the bill, though it has made no clear commitment to vetoing. Actually, since the time I sat down to write this over the weekend, that looks like that's also starting to change, partly as a consequence of the public outcry and just the lack of movement on some of the valid privacy questions. Let's hope that that continues to change in the right direction and that that public pressure continues to slow, if not outright stop, this bill. Slashdot noted an impressive milestone for a great project. Project Gutenberg enlists volunteers to scan, correct, and proofread public domain books. The results are available for free download in a variety of formats. I actually read most of Edgar Rice Burroughs' Mars books from Project Gutenberg. Unfortunately, not all of his great adventure stories are in the public domain, but the bulk of that particular series are. It's still a valuable source of ebooks for me, ones I know have no DRM. There's no good reason for that, this being all volunteer and the titles in question not being under the auspices of copyright anymore. The project just announced that its 100,000 plus volunteers have successfully processed 25,000 books. I was curious to see how many books are available at the various popular commercial sources for your ebooks like Amazon, Google, and Apple. Digging through Google's FAQ, my own online store of choice, given that most of my mobile devices are, well, all of my mobile devices are Android-based, they cite over 5 million titles, a 200-fold larger library than what Gutenberg has been able to accomplish. Of course, Google being far better resourced. I wish the difference was really smaller than that, but given that Gutenberg is all about open commitment of time and the impoverished state too, I think this is a bit of an indictment of where the public domain is these days. I still think that's impressive, and I have to wonder how many of that of those 5 million titles are things that are just not comparable in any way. They're not works of great literature, they're business books or other how-to books. Some subset of those might also be things that were taken very freely, of course, and entirely within their rights from Project Gutenberg to make them available. I know that the first couple of titles that came in the Android Google Play app actually were public domain books, and they might very well have been based on the amazing effort that's gone into this project, celebrating this awesome milestone. That's going to do it for this episode. As always, I want to thank you for listening, and if you enjoyed the show, please do tell a friend. Or go to the website at thecommandline.net and click on the support link for all the ways you can financially help out with the production of the show. If you have a question, suggestion, or correction, you can send those to feedback at thecommandline.net, or you can post those as a comment up on the website. If you're away from your computer and the internet at the moment, call the listener comment line at area code 240-949-2638. If you need to get in touch with me securely, details of my public key pair can be found at thecommandline.net/gnupg-fingerprints. The next episode should be a feature cast. I'm hoping to rant a little bit about the proposal to bake DRM into HTML as a standard. That should go out in the feed as usual next week. So until then, don't forget to hack your world. I would like to thank the Internet Archive for media hosting and bandwidth. The views expressed on this program are my own, and where applicable, those of my guests, and in no way reflect those of my employer or anyone else. This show is produced from 100% recycled bits. Except where noted, permission to recycle those further is granted under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 United States license. That means you're free to change this show as much as you like, as long as you don't alter credits and you share your changes under the same license.